Zesty Garden, and it's our new Bug Bites module. That's B-Y-T-E-S. And this is a new endeavor of the Zesty Garden program to bring you some of the information that's coming out that's new in the world of insects, or fascinating in some fashion. And Diane Alston is USU's extension entomologist. And Diane, I appreciate you coming in and doing this. And the first one we're looking at is the butterfly changes its spots, eye spots, that is. And this is not really, I mean, it's unusual, but it's not the only insect or animal that does this. So why don't you explain what's happening?
Yeah, so this was a really cool research study. They actually did the research in the lab, but it's based on what they observed in nature. And this particular butterfly, its common name, I looked it up to see what it was. It's called the squinting bush brown. Isn't that an enticing name? But it's in a family of butterflies. It's very common. It's the most common group of butterflies in the world. So like the monarch is in that, the admiral, the you know, a lot of the common butterflies that we know around
here. It
looks
like cabbage butterfly size.
Yeah, it's like a medium-sized butterfly. The checker spot, the comma, we have a lot of, it's not the swallowtail type, so that's a different group, but a lot of the other common butterflies that we have around here in this family called Nymphalidae, which means brush-footed, which are the brush-footed butterflies, the nymphs of the forest, so to speak. And this particular one is native to Eastern Africa, but this group of researchers that were interested in a concept called phenotypic plasticity. And what that means,
love that.
Isn't that a neat word? Well, plasticity, you might guess, it's kind of like, it's kind of plastic, it can mold, it can move, it can melt, it can be adjustable, and that's exactly what it means. And phenotype is the set of characters that you see. So your phenotypes is you know, your hair color, the shape of your nose, that you can grow a nice full mustache, you know, and you have a great smile with little smile lines. I have the smile lines too. You know, those are your phenotypes, yeah. But it's also your behaviors too. So that you, you know, when you sip your cup of water, that you do it in this certain way, or that when you whistle a tune, you know, you do certain little behaviors. So those are all phenotypes, kind of these characteristics that define us or and all animals out there. And so these were the group of evolutionary-based entomologists or biologists that were interested in studying this particular butterfly, because what they observed in nature was that there seemed to be some plasticity to its responses depending on the environment. And so there's certain genes in this butterfly that code for these eye spots. And so these eye spots are actually on the undersides of the wings. And so when the butterfly wings are unfolded and held flat and open, which is common the way they hold their wings, like you think about monarchs, how oftentimes you see their wings down flat. I think on the top, they're pretty much just kind of a dull brown color because it wants to fit it. It wants to be camouflaged in its woodland environment in Eastern Africa. But when it folds its wings up, on the underside near the hind edge of the wing are these big, bright eye spots. And so those evolved to be protection against predators. And so in the wet season, when its primary predator is probably multiple things, but praying mantids in particular are one of its primary predators, where it's landing in trees or on plants, bushes, and the praying mantids are hiding there waiting for its food to come along, it evolved those eye spots to be to startle the mantid. And so when it leaps to attack and grab the butterfly, it will often go for those eye spots thinking that's the head and that's the part that, you know, predators usually want to attack and, you know, go for the kill, so to speak. But what happens instead is it grabs the hind edge of the wing of the butterfly, and it might break some of the wing off, but the butterfly, of course, immediately flies away and it escapes and it goes on to live another day. It might have a tattered wing, but hey, it's alive. So that's where these eye spots evolved in the wet season. But in Eastern Africa, they're two distinct seasons, unlike here in Utah where we have cold like snow today versus hot in the summer. It's wet and dry. In the dry season, then, it has a different group of major predators. And these are many of these are bird species, so different, very different kind of predator. And so in that case, in the woodland habitat, it actually wants to now be camouflaged. It doesn't want to have a bright eye spot that could attract a bird to find it and, you know, and fly down and track it down and grab it. And so in the wet season, these same genes that code for these eye spots actually tone down the color, turn off that bright color, and the pictures that they have on the website with the article show that in the dry season the spots are very light,
drab looking.
They're not sharp and bright and focused. So the same butterfly, it goes through multiple generations a year, but these same genes can code for very different kinds of phenotypes. Bright, bold eye spots or dull, not very obvious eye spots.
Now, this, tell me again what it's called, phenotypic plasticity.
Yeah.
This happens also in animals. You look at rabbits, the Arctic hare, it changes from white. There's an Arctic fox, you know, going from this white color to the more drab color in the summer.
Because you can imagine if they're big, bright white things standing out in the middle of the summer environment, brown and green, they're going to be big targets for their predators.
But they're dropping their fur or their hair, which changes. How does that happen in a butterfly? I mean, it doesn't exchange a wing. It's not going through a pupation to get this different
color. Well, in this case, it's actually going to be different individuals. So see, this butterfly has multiple generations in a year.
Okay.
And so when the environment is wet or dry, it affects this gene, however it's functioning, you know, turning it on or ramping it up versus is ramping it down to affect this coloration or this eye spot effect. But I thought this study was particularly cool because they did a neat thing where they actually cut out eye spots and they pasted them on butterflies in their laboratory arenas. It looked like it was in some little mesh cages they were using. And so they had butterflies with and without the eye spots that they exposed then to praying mantids. And they videotaped the responses. So it's pretty cool. You can see a little video clip on this Entomology Today website with a story. And so when the eye spot was present, the big prominent one, it did just what we talked about earlier. The mantid lunged at it. It caught the hind edge of the wing. The butterfly flew off and escaped.
And they'll show you it in slow motion.
Right. It's pretty neat. But then when they didn't have the eye, or they had this dull eye spot, the not prominent eye spot present, then what happened? Did you watch?
It went right after, grabbed the head and began chewing.
And it just munched it right on down. So if anybody wants to see a mantid getting a snack, you got to watch this website, this video. And so that's pretty cool that they were able to show, you know, they replicated it many times, of course. You have to do that in science. And saw this very consistent result. And so I just think that's such a cool example of how this genetically dictated phenotype, this character that these butterflies have, can be so modified by the environment and lead to a very different looking organism and enable it to survive under different kinds of stresses, different kinds of predators.
And that's the changing spots of the butterfly. And you've been listening to it on the Zesty Garden with our Bug Bites module. And Diane Alston is USU's extension entomologist. Thanks, Diane.
Yeah, you're welcome.
It's now time for a book interview, and recently I received in the mail one entitled Gardenpedia, an A to Z guide to gardening terms. And on the line with me is Maria Zampini. She's president of Upshoot LLC. It's a boutique horticulture marketing firm focusing on new plant introductions and gardening-related products. She's also the director of plant development for the HGTV Home Plant Collection. Maria writes for green industry trade journals and consumer magazines such as Nursery Management, Garden Center, and state-by-state gardening magazines. Maria, thank you for joining me on today's Zesty Garden.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Do you know, I got the book, and I was thinking, where was this book when I first started learning gardening? It would have been really helpful. But then as I started going through it, I still found some things that were helpful to me, even though I've been gardening since I was 3 years old.
Oh, well, we love to hear that. That's great, because we do think it has applications both for people who have been in the horticultural industry as well as the novice gardener.
So what was your impetus for putting the book together? How did you decide, okay, it's time to get something together?
Well, you know, I am a fourth-generation wholesale nurseryman, and I grew up in the industry. And we had a wholesale nursery and a retail garden center, and we would always hire people, obviously seasonally, and many times they had no experience in horticulture. And they would get confused or didn't know some of the gardening jargon that we used. And I always had it in the back of my mind, gee, you know, I should do a little dictionary that should be part of our employee training manual. And it just never happened. And then as I went on in my career to start writing, and writing in particular for consumer gardening magazines, you know, I would, every once in a while, I'd catch myself and go, well, you know, I know what this term is, and I'm including it in my article, but that's because I've been around forever in the industry, and I kind of grew up with the term. How do I explain it to somebody else? And then I asked Pam Bennett of the Ohio State University to help me write the book and to be my co-author, and she said, well, you know, Maria, I'm in charge of the master gardeners in our state, and quite often there is no, like, text manual. And something like this would be perfect for that new person trying to learn more about gardening. So it was really just this kind of series of events that led me to further develop this idea and eventually write the book.
Well, now, I love that you have your own garden muse. Apparently, that's your father.
Yeah, my dad. Yeah, he's quite the individual, and he's still my partner in business. And I'm very lucky to have someone who is not only my father, but he's my mentor and my best friend, too.
How important is that to have someone to mentor you? I know for me it was my mother. The green thumb passed from my grandmother to my mom to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I do think that is important, because why should you struggle to make the same mistakes that someone else has already made? You know, you look for mentors in your business life. Why not look for them within your gardening life? And it can be your neighbor down the street, a fellow master gardener, someone who's in the industry. There's you know, I think it's really important to always have that feeling that, oh, I'm not alone. It wasn't just me that made that mistake. Someone else has been through this. So I think that's pretty helpful.
Well, let's take a look at the book here. It starts out and has, looks like a stepping stone. Written on it is, An Hour in the Garden Puts Life's Problems in Perspective, which I absolutely believe in, which is why I love going out and pulling weeds and being able to spend time out there, because I'm not as grouchy when I come back in the house. And so looking at this book, how do you foresee people, how would you like them to use the book?
Well, you know, it's funny. Originally, I guess we thought, well, hey, if they have a term they don't know, this would be the go-to reference. Because here's what we found. When we thought of the idea, you know, we did a little research, and we found that the majority of the books that were out there that gave garden terminology, you know, that explained garden terminology, were still very technical in nature. And also, if you Google something, a lot of times you're still coming up with something technical in nature. And to us, this book is very conversational in tone. It's like if you and I were just sitting, having a conversation, and you asked me, you know, what's grafting, it would be how I would explain it to you in my own words. And so that's why I think it's kind of a nice sort of a, just like a pocket dictionary. So if they're sitting there and they're reading an article and they go, gee, I don't know what this is, and I don't want to be stupid and ask somebody and seem silly that I don't know what it is, here's where they can go to. It can kind of be their best friend. If their best friend was sitting there and could explain something to them, this would be it. But we've also found a lot of people, and some of the reviews and comments we're getting is there was one the other day by a lady who writes for Vegetable Gardening Magazine, and she said, who would think I'd ever sit down and read a dictionary from cover to cover? And I guess that really speaks to the conversational tone, that it's also a book you can read front to back and still go back afterwards and utilize it as need be.
Well, and as I was reading through it, that's part of what I enjoyed was I'm thinking, well, I know most of these terms, but you have additional information on those terms. So I found myself kind of going, oh, I didn't realize that. So,
right.
And it's about 7x7. So it's not a large book. So it's easily tucked away into a bucket that you might carry around with you with your gardening tools as you go about the garden. But it's also, I've found to be quite helpful just going through the list at the back of the book and searching out different topics. I kind of like to bounce back and forth. And so the first part of the book, you talk a little bit about the difference between Latin and common names. So why don't you explain how you put that into the book?
Sure. Well, you know, this was something we really struggled with for a while. If we're going to mention plants, do we use, you know, the botanical name, the Latin name, or do we use common names? And within the industry, we tend to talk in Latin when we're referring to plants, and there's a reason for that. And the example we give is if you walked into a retail garden center and you asked for a red maple, you know, that garden, that person working at that garden center doesn't know, do you mean a red maple as in Acer rubrum or a Crimson King red maple that has red, you know, maroon red leaves? Or do they do you maybe mean a Japanese red maple? So if you're, you know, and that's why using the common names can be a little confusing. If you use the Latin terminology, you have just really pinpointed exactly what you mean. So throughout the book, we do try and go to Latin names and utilize those as often as possible, and then also accompany the common name too.
Now, before
we try and use both.
Before we dive into the innards of the book, I wanted to make mention of what you have at the back of the book. It's a list of resources. What types of resources will listeners find?
Oh, there's a lot of different resources. There were many books that we look to that are kind of our go-to books. And some of them are more industry type books that I wasn't, you know, we weren't really sure, gee, does the general gardener know about, you know, Dr. Michael Durr, who's kind of the god of horticulture when it comes to woody ornamentals. And his book is very, very detailed and gives a lot of good information. So, you know, that was one thing. We've got websites. We have other items that are more technology-driven, such as there's a great app out by Dr. Alan Armitage. It's Greatest Annuals and Perennials. Well, we found information right off of that that we thought was good. So we're giving you some of the references that not only we used for our book, but that you can utilize too as gardeners moving forward.
So now, as I look at this, so if I see Purdue's Annual Doctor, what does that particular app do?
Well, that's a good question, because that one I'm not familiar with. That's one that my co-author recommended. So I myself am not familiar with that one. Sorry.
Have you got a suggestion?
Pardon me?
Do you have a suggestion? What would be the first app that you would pull down, and what does it do?
Well, the first app, you know, one of the apps that I do use is the one I just mentioned, Dr. Armitage's Greatest Annuals and Perennials.
Yeah.
And his is great because it gives deer browsing and rabbit browsing ratings on annuals, perennials, vegetables. He's got videos on there so you can see the plants. He has garden centers listed so that you can look up and say, hey, I really like this plant. Where can I find it in my area? You can put in your zip code or, you know, check out your state and see what garden centers are listed. So that's a pretty interesting app and very photo rich, lots of photos in it too. Just like our book, that was one of the things we did was, you know, when you, it's not just terms. It's not just here's what something is. It's here's why it might be important to you as a gardener, and then here's also a photo that backs up the majority of the terms that we have, so you can visually see what we mean too.
Well, for instance, I just happened to open up to a term that, well, and there's a picture of it. It says daughter. I had no idea what daughter was. And I'd heard the term, but I'd never seen it. Now I understand what it is. Or pendulous. What do you mean by pendulous? Well, it shows you the flowers and what pendulous would actually mean. So that's very helpful.
Right.
Let's just start at the top. I'm thinking of perennial versus biennial versus annual? I get that question all the time. How does your book explain
right.
that?
Right. So, you know, if I was explaining it to somebody, an annual is something that is only going to flower for 1 year, and that's more like your petunias, things of that nature, where once frost comes, it's killed, it's dead, it's not coming back next year, okay? To me, a biennial is something that's going to, and I can't, there's some herbs that are like this that you would be familiar with, where you plant it, it's here this year, it's here next year, and then that's it. It's gone. It's not coming back again. A perennial is something that is going to come back year after year after year. It's like an annual in that it has a lot of flower power to it, but that it also dies right back down to the ground, and you're not going to see really much of anything during the winter time, you know, versus a woody plant where you've got stems or branches or berries or something that you kind of have to look at during the winter time. You know, your perennial is just going to die back down to the ground in most areas of the country. So that would be just a quick analogy of those terms.
How did you decide what to put into the book?
Oh, that took a little bit of time.
I can imagine.
You know, Pam and I both brainstormed individually and then put our list together. And we probably ended up with about 600 terms that we narrowed down to about 300. And we just went, is this something the average Joe should know or might need to know if they're gardening? We still have this whole big bevy of other terms sitting there that are probably useful, but they're really more for the totally advanced, maybe plant nerd person. And so we didn't use those. It was mainly the common stuff that we felt people really needed to know.
And are they general terms, or do you have more specific things? Like, I'm assuming that under herbs, it's just talking about herbs, and you're not trying to go into the different types of herbs.
Right, and you're exactly right. In a lot of cases, we kept it very high level. You know, we didn't get down into the nitty-gritty because there's other books that handle that. Someone asked me, well, what about insects? Do you have something about that? Well, we do talk about insects in a general term, but there's so much good information out there from Extension that shows pictures of all the different types of bugs and really gets into detail, or there's a really great book from St. Lin's Press called Good Bug, Bad Bug. Now, you know, it gets into the detail that we didn't feel we needed to do in this book, but this is enough for the starter person to get going.
And if you tried to put everything in, the book would be way too heavy and big to carry around.
You got it. And we had to go, you know what, it can't be everything. But I have to tell you, as we went through the process, it was funny. We would go through, and all of a sudden we would go, oh my goodness, we forgot this term. How could we possibly not think to put this in the book? So we are telling people who are reading it, as you read through it, if you think there are terms we've missed this time, please let us know. Who knows? Maybe someday there will be an updated version, and or that version 2 will come out, and we want to know terms that people feel are important that we may have accidentally overlooked.
Have you already received a couple of those back?
Well, you know, it's funny. I did an interview yesterday, and she had told me a couple of the words she wanted to talk about, and I read the one description, and I went, oh, my God, Maria, you are such an idiot. How could you forget this one? Caliper. We're talking about girth and how you
yes.
measure trees, and in the industry, we always refer to it as caliper. Didn't put the word caliper in there. So I think it's the first word on the list of one we want to add next time.
I did notice the word girth in here, I believe.
Yep, it's in there, but we didn't also reference caliper. So, but that's, hey, live and learn.
We're talking about the book Gardenpedia, an A to Z guide to gardening terms. One of the authors that I have on the line with me is Maria Zampini. So, Maria, what would you say is Did you come across a favorite term, not necessarily how you would use it in the garden, but you just liked the word and its description?
Yeah, I think one of my favorites is habit. And you can say, well, gee, habit, that's such a simple word. Everybody should know that. And it's not so much the word, it's how maybe it's used, or the lack of how people think about it when they're gardening or designing their landscape. And I described it as this: it's really important for you to know whether your plant that you want or the area that you need to fill really should have something upright or something pendulous or something that's round. And part of habit is knowing also not only the shape, but the mature height and spread of that plant. And to me, that's important because, and this is how I equate it in the book, if you're a woman and you're a size 16, all right, you don't go try and stuff yourself into a size 8 pair of pants because it just doesn't work. And so many times I've seen people who have, say, a beautiful picture window. They want something to go in front of it, but they don't want to block their view. And instead of getting a shrub that only gets 3 by 4 foot, that they can just leave it, it does its thing, it doesn't get too big, doesn't obstruct its view, they go and buy something that's 30 by 40 foot, and they've got to hack it and whack it constantly and keep giving it this haircut so that it performs the way they want it to when it wasn't made to do that naturally. So that just gives you a little example of what you can expect in the book. But habit is so important when people are choosing their plants for their landscape and where they go. There's always the right plant for the right place, and we need to remember that.
And this book will help you in picking those plants, not by name, but exactly by topic and mm-hmm. by definition. And so, Maria, we've reached the end of our time. I wish I had some more with you, but thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having us and for talking about Gardenpedia. We really appreciate it.
It's the new book, Gardenpedia, an A to Z Guide to Gardening Terms. Maria Zampini is president of Upshoot LLC, a boutique horticulture marketing firm focusing on new plant introductions, and is joining me for the program. Stay tuned. Coming up next is The Green Room. You're listening to The Zesty Garden, and in the studio with me is Shane Taylor, horticultural specialist and buyer with Cactus and Tropicals in Salt Lake City. And it's our series of recommended houseplants, and today it's a zygocactus, or as I know it, and you may know it, as a Christmas cactus. Why is this one on your list?
Oh, it's another one of those legacy plants. I mean, who doesn't have a piece of their grandparents' Christmas cactus at home?
And I've certainly, that's why I've got mine. My grandmother had this western-facing room that just was full of windows, and she had tons of plants in there, and this was one that her grandmother gave to her. And so now I've got it from my grandmother. So we're talking 6 generations old, and it just keeps going. I love it.
Yeah, they're amazing. They actually are a true variety of cactus, although they're a little unusual in that they don't normally, they're not found in the desert. You wouldn't walk out into the Mojave and see a zygocactus, but you'd have to find them down in the rainforest. They'd live up in the trees with the orchids and the tillandsias and the other epiphytic plants. They perch on the sides of trees.
So it's an epiphyte?
It's an epiphyte, yeah.
So how come I've got mine in soil?
Well, that's how they've grown them for years. And the cultivars that we have nowadays are well adapted to porous, well-draining soil, and they do well in that. They have adapted to life in soil way better than orchids ever did, or any of the other varieties of epiphytic plants. They're a little bit like staghorn ferns in that regard, that they can adapt to life in soil even though they're an epiphyte, and they'll do just fine. They'll do great.
Okay, so this explains something with my own. I've got 1, 2, 3, 4 of these, one here at work and 3 at home. And the one at home, I keep thinking, I need to split this. It's just... all it is roots.
Yeah. At the point where the soil, you always have to worry when the soil becomes really dense and compact. And because these are plants that can live for a century, if not more, it's a good idea to every 5 to 7 years get in there, poke a bunch of holes down in the soil, take a pencil or a pen, kind of stir up that soil, try to get as much air back into the soil as possible.
So I can just poke holes into what I think it looks like it's really root bound, just all around the plant?
Yeah. And at this point, it might be a good idea to take it out. If it's been a long time since it's been freshened up and transplanted, it would probably be a good idea to give it some fresh soil.
So maybe a little bit of both. I mean, poke the holes in it and then transplant it into a pot one bigger size.
Yeah, step it up a little bit. Or take the opportunity, pinch a bunch of leaves off of it, and then step it down. Actually, take some of the root ball off of it and either keep it in the same size pot or move it down a little bit. And you can take those leaves that you pulled off of it and put them in soil and grow whole new plants. And that's how most people get theirs, as a start from somebody else's.
So it's kind of like an African violet. You just stick the leaves?
You just stick the leaf. Yep. You
can with just, maybe a little bit of rooting hormone?
Yeah. You can take the end that has been cut and dip it in rooting hormone, stick it in. You don't even really need rooting hormone for them to take root and grow.
So just one leaf, or do I take, like, they come, the leaves kind of keep growing on the ends of the previous leaf, and do I take a whole series of those, or just one, or yes?
Yes, both. Both work, yeah. They're an individual segment, or a whole bunch of leaves will grow. They're amazing that way. They're great.
Can you split the plant itself? Like, if I've got several branches that are coming up, can I take one of those off?
If they are individual plants in the pot, you can divide it at the root. Often you'll find that over time, if it's a really old plant, it will be maybe one, two plants at most in the soil. And so dividing it's going to be a lot harder. But as long as it's two separate things, you can work the root ball apart. They have really strong roots, and sometimes it's hard to get in there and separate the root systems without just completely destroying them.
Now, the one I've got here at work, the blossoms are scarlet red, and it's in this clay pot, and it can't be more than 5 inches across, but the plant above it is probably a foot across at least, and it's sitting, it gets bright indirect light, sometimes direct light. And I figure as long as it keeps producing blossoms that I probably don't need to step it up another pot size, even though the gardener in me wants to do that anyway because it's just absolutely packed with roots. But this thing just keeps going. I had a huge flush of blossoms about January. And then the end of February, I had another flush, about half as many, and I'm just finishing up with the third flush. There were only like four or five blossoms on it for the whole thing, but it just was totally amazing to me.
Yeah, they're one of the hallmarks of epiphytic plants is the fact that you notice on many different kinds of epiphytes, like Phalaenopsis orchids and staghorn ferns, is the pot is not really in regular, it's not in... what's the word for it? It's not really in scale with the plant above. They're often so much smaller, but that's because in nature they have to really adapt to growing in these little nooks and crannies and doing their best. So these are plants that are well adapted to living in small spaces. And when you think about it, roots take a lot of the same nutrients as blooms. So I think one of the successes of your Christmas cactus is the fact that you haven't transplanted it. The fact that it doesn't need all that extra space, and the fact that it can use the nutrients that it has available to it to then flower instead of grow roots. Because if you were to take it and put it in a bigger pot, it would want to fill out that pot before its next flowering. So it may take a break from flowering for even a few years.
I don't want that.
Yeah. Well, there's another quirk about them is the reason they flower is a little bit of an interesting quirk with that type of plant. They're photosensitive. They feel the length of day. They sense how long day and night is. And when day and night, when they get an equal amount of light for day and night for about 2 or 3 weeks in a row, they set bud. So that's one of the reasons that they bloom shortly after the first day of fall or the first day of spring is because that's when days naturally even out. But if they're in an environment that also has good dark nights and bright days, and maybe it's supplemented with artificial lighting, they can bloom any time. And like yours, mine bloom 4 or 5 times a year, it seems. And some flushes, it seems like the spring, the mid-spring flush and the Thanksgiving time flush are the two big ones, but then they'll send out a couple flowers here and there the rest of the year. And that, it just is great. You just don't have to do a whole lot for a lot of reward. Those flowers are so interesting.
You know, like a Phalaenopsis orchid, this is probably one of my favorite indoor plants for flowers, because when someone walks into my office, their eye just goes right to that plant when it's in blossom, because it's really scarlet red. Now, I've seen there's like a hot pink. I've seen these in white. Are there any other colors that the flowers come in?
There's a whole bunch of yellow and peach colors now that are available. I've got a yellow at home.
Mm.
They've crossed the yellow and some of the pinks to end up with some peach colors. It's just always, they always seem to be adding a few new colors every year. We primarily only get them in the late fall, the holiday season. That's when they're the most available at our shop. And every year when they come in, if I see a new color, I always have to snag it.
Yeah.
It's funny because our customers do the same thing. They know when the season starts at our store. And so they come in and are ready to pick up those rare colors before anybody else can get them.
So how do you keep your house from being just full of plants?
Well, it is just full of plants.
With having enough room to live in.
Well, that the nice thing is it's pretty much winter that's tough. I've got shady patios that I move stuff out in the summer, but every single one of my windows is jammed full of plants. It's one of the drawbacks of being a plant addict is you pretty much take every prime bit of real estate in your home that can have a plant. Every table has a plant. Every corner has a plant.
I all these plants that you've brought in over the year, I want to run right out and get one and put it in, because I think, oh, here's another great location for it. But there's nothing better, at least for me, when I walk into a living space and you see plants. It softens the edges of the home, whether you're in an apartment or have a large house or in your office, it just makes it more of a living space.
What does? It's good. It's also good for you. I mean, plants are filtering the air. They're doing their thing pretty much all day long, and cleaning, taking toxins out of the air, stuff that our carpeting and our paint on our walls and stuff is putting out, and it's taking it, it's locking that in its root system, so that we're not breathing it in. So it's a good thing to have plants, and you don't have to be a crazy plant addict. You know, every space of your home or apartment, like you said, you just soften certain spots, and there are plants that will grow in almost any situation. It's just knowing to get the right one for that. It's often people, when they fail, it's because they've taken and they've picked a plant for its appearance and not for its ability to grow in the situation that they want it to be in. So there's a little bit of give and take that you have to do with that.
Now, the one we've been talking about today is the zygocactus, and I've got to ask just a couple more questions. I also have one that my grandmother gave to me before she passed away, and she called it an Easter cactus. And they have rounded leaves rather than the jagged leaves with the Christmas cactus. And the flower, it's kind of the same color, that scarlet color, but it looks more like a fringed skirt rather than this kind of a pointed, many-leveled type of flower. Is it the same family?
It's not the same family. Well, okay, it is the same family. It's a different genus, though. So the spring cactus come from cooler climates, and although they grow very similar in appearance, they do have those, it's more of a daisy-like flower, mm-hmm. versus the Christmas cactus is more of a tube-like flower. And the spring cactus requires, instead of the day and night thing, it requires colder temperatures. So you have to give it temperature swings of about 20 degrees between day and night in order for it to set bud and flower.
The light bulb just went on. So I'm like, okay, well, this makes total sense because it's in my south living room and I might get one or two on it, but it just never looks that great. So I need to be putting this in a darker area as well, or just a cooler area?
Just a cooler area. This is actually a good one to bring out on your patio in the summer. And you want to put it on a shady patio and you want to leave it out there all summer long and into the fall. And when they start forecasting for temperatures, maybe in the upper 30s at that point at night, then you bring it in. And that gives it enough time to feel that temperature change between day and night that it will set bud and bloom.
Another light bulb just went off. My grandmother used to put it on her back porch.
That'll do it. Yeah, right there.
Okay. Well, you've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Shane Taylor is the horticultural specialist and buyer with Cactus and Tropicals. And today's recommended plant is the zygocactus, or Christmas cactus, as it's otherwise known. Shane, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Brian.
Happy winter, everybody. This is Nancy Williams in for Petals and Prose with the Zesty Garden. And I'm reading today from a book by Kathleen Dean Moore called Reflections on Moving Water, River Walking. Kathleen Moore is a philosophy professor at Oregon State University in Corvallis, with essays that have been published widely in the New York Times and Northwest Review journals such as Willow Springs and others. She's writing today on the Smohalla River in the sun. She writes, Frank nosed the raft into a reed bed along the shore, and Jonathan stepped out into ankle-deep water, holding the bowline in one hand. The raft swung round in the current, levered in parallel to shore, and as Jonathan let out on the rope, dropped into a small bay, where it rocked in quiet water. From the shoreline, we walked a faint trail across a stone beach up the bank, between two cottonwoods and into a grassy opening in a pine forest. We considered the view. A person sitting in the pine opening could see across the river to basalt ramparts at the knees of Bear Mountain. Drinking water? Just down the beach, Alder Creek filtered through a thicket of willows, promising fresh water. One last test. Blocking the sun with our outstretched hands, we checked the direction of light to be sure that the opening would have afternoon shade and morning sun. Yes, yes, and yes again. So welcome home, we said to each other, and set to work. Setting up camp is a dance of changing partners and sure steps, played out in primary colors and carefully crafted gear. Jonathan tied the bowline to a thick root. Frank unstrapped the bow bags. Aaron and I stepped into the water. Then, pivoting like dancers in a Virginia reel, we passed the gear out of the boat, Frank to Aaron to me to Jonathan, who piled it on the shore. Against gray rock, the heap of equipment shone bright as peeled crayons, a blue coil of rope, a white cowboy hat, a pallet of food buckets color-coded to the sky, blue bucket for breakfast, yellow bucket for lunches, orange bucket for suppers. A frog-green rubber bag for the sleeping bags, a blue bag for the tent, four school bus yellow clothes bags, and an orange insulated cooker. Soon home unfolded, expanded, inflated, until it filled the grassy space under the pines. We popped a big tent up on the grass. Inside the tent, four sleeping bags spread out over four sleeping pads. A clothesline flapping with T-shirts spanned the distance between two trees. On the beach, a kayak and a float tube grew fat with air, fly rods linked to great length, long lines uncoiled. From the supper bucket came peanuts and bourbon. A green stove unfolded from a package the size of a lunchbox. On the stove, rice plumped up white and light in a covered pot that let off little puffs of steam, and mixed with boiling water, an envelope of pink powder swelled into Texas chili. The next morning we broke camp, stuffing everything back into its containers. Then we were a blue rubber raft with a red bottom, 14 feet by 5 feet, self-contained, self-sufficient for four more river days and nights. I have a theory about wilderness excursions like this one. I think that one of the greatest pleasures people get from traveling into a wild place is the feeling of security and safety the experience provides. That feeling comes from knowing that no matter what happens, you can be safe and cozy with only what you have in your backpack or on your raft or trailing behind your skis on a sled. Let it rain. Let it snow. Let lightning strike all around. Let a flood destroy the bridge at the trailhead. From your pack, you can pull what you need to make a safe little hearth and a home for you and the people you love. Domesticity is the central pleasure of the wilderness experience. I acknowledge that my wilderness experiences are filtered through a woman's eyes and that women are supposed to be domestic. Two facts that may explain my point of view, but I don't think it's only women who feel the deep satisfaction of playing house in the woods. Thoreau had his cabin at Walden Pond. Henry Beston had his outermost house. Wendell Berry his long-legged house. Domesticity is everywhere you look in nature writing and wilderness journals, regardless of the author's gender. Take Colin Fletcher, for example, who in his 1968 book, The Man Who Walked Through Time, describes his camp routine again and again, never leaving out a single loving detail. First, he chooses a site with a stupendous view over the Grand Canyon. Then he wedges his walking staff against a rock. He braces his pack against his staff in such a way that the pack becomes a backrest. His sleeping bag against the pack. His canteen goes just here. His binoculars go just there. All his equipment is arranged to give him a comfortable, secure home on the slick rock edge of an abyss. Margaret Murray, backpacking in the Brooks Range, hurried through a description of the landscape so she could tell about the bed Olas made. Quote, Olas had found a little mossy spot where we could camp. A cold wind had started to blow, but the campsite was sheltered, and somehow, as soon as a fire is burning, life always seems possible, even joyous. Olas gathered some dry moss from the rocks above us and made a fine bed, building up the edges with rocks so we wouldn't roll off. The next morning we started off at 8 o'clock, taking a last grateful look at our little haven and wondering what a grizzly might think of that mossy bed. In the midst of the wildest country left on earth, the subarctic mountains, a scene of the most tender domesticity holds our attention and resonates with our own sense of pleasure. So deep is the pleasure of keeping house in the woods that when there is no wild land around, people make do with a near substitute, the branches of a tree. When Jonathan was 10, he hauled the top of an old picnic table up into the crotch of a big oak growing at the corner of our city lot. With long spikes, he nailed it in place. He made a ladder by cutting notches into a sapling with an axe and bracing the stair-stepped tree up into the oak. Then he roofed his house with sticks that he had collected one by one and hauled into the treehouse with as much care as a mother robin building a nest. To make a hoist, he attached a rope to a turkey roaster and slung the rope over a tall branch. In a fork in the tree, a pile of pine cones was carefully cached away as defense against intruders when Jonathan sat in his tree under his roof and ate a cupcake pulled up in his turkey roaster. His happiness was complete. My own treehouse was in a willow in the backyard at 80 Craft Street. It was a cube made out of discarded window screens, so it let the breeze in and kept out the Ohio bugs. What made it distinctive was that in its entryway was low and small so that all visitors had to crawl in on their hands and knees. The entryway was carpeted with a rag rug, and embedded in the rug were thumbtacks, point up, to keep out the boys. If a person didn't know where to crawl, he would grind a tack right into his knee. Jonathan and his friends spent the night in his treehouse. They didn't take much equipment, just sleeping bags and more nacho-flavored corn chips than any adult could eat in a lifetime. At about that same age, I slept out in my treehouse, too, with a pile of Nancy Drew mysteries, a box of saltines, grape Kool-Aid in a plastic pitcher, a flashlight, a bedroll, and a pillow. Of course, a boy did come, and he did get a thumbtack in his knee, which made the whole experience a great triumph. I think of those times when I walk by the rest of the dusky-footed wood rats down by the river. Dusky-footed wood rats are long-tailed rodents about the size and color of a baked potato. Their stomachs are creamy white, though, and their feet are as dark as if they'd walked in walnut husks after a rain. The rats have built a nest in the middle of a mean, thick blackberry bramble, a tangle of canes as thick as thumbs growing 10 feet tall and curving down into the ground. The nest is made of 5-inch lengths of blackberry canes piled in what looks like a careless heap, except that this heap is higher than my head. Each summer, the blackberry canes grow up over the house, and each fall, the thicket is stripped and the house is a foot taller. Anything coming into this treehouse has to find its way over recurving spines a 1/2 inch long. Inside, there must be tunnels cut through the canes, and there must be nest cavities lined with thistle silk to shelter the naked nursing rat babies. Safe and warm, but there is no way to tell without destroying the nest. Late one winter many years ago, we skied with our children into Fawn Lake in the Cascades, pulling our camping gear in sleds harnessed to long poles at our waists. Gray moisture was seeping down through the hemlocks, and it seemed to be getting dark, even though it was the middle of the day. All of us were uneasy, playing out a plan that was obviously a mistake in such miserable weather. But our children were especially unhappy. Slouched over ski poles braced against their armpits, they stood on their skis with their arms dangling, disgusted at the prospect of spending the night on this soggy, cold, monochromatic mountain. Frank and I left them at the shore of the lake and skied around in the woods, trying to find a flat place to pitch a tent. By the time we returned, the children had each collected an armload of pine cones, boughs, and fallen sticks and piled it at the base of a lodge pole pine to make a seat. They had collected another heap of sticks for a footrest. Little skis were stuck at odd angles into a snowbank, and wet mittens hung from the branches of a nearby tree. There they sat on their little dry seats, leaning against their tree, passing a bag of pretzels back and forth through the fog. Human beings have simple needs: to eat, to drink, to nest, to have children, and keep them safe. We play out the satisfaction of those needs with complex equipment and long excursions to wild places where we spend the end of each day happily engaged in homemaking. The greater the challenge, the greater the comfort when we overcome that challenge. Violent weather, isolation, extremes, all of these raise the value of warmth and safety, so it is necessary to seek out storms. I wouldn't argue that this is the only reason people go to wild places, but I believe it's an important one. How far can I go? How high can I climb? How little can I bring along? Are questions that end in a phrase that is usually unstated but always understood. And still be safe and warm. Thanks for being with me. This is Nancy Williams, and I'll see you next time